Welcome to the Radio Book Club on Community Radio KGNU, Boulder, Denver and Fort Collins. Today in studio we have Pulitzer Prize winning reporter and author David Phillips. His latest book is Wild Horse Country, The History, Myth and Future of the Mustang. And as always, my co-host is Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. Arsene, why did you select this book?
Well, I read this a few months ago and I thought it was very entertaining. He goes into all different aspects about the wild horses. But I also thought it was a really good story to think about the West and what the West is, what the West was, and what it perhaps is becoming. And so I thought for all these reasons, there's so many great aspects to dive into in this book. I thought it'd be wonderful.
Well, David, it's great to have you in the studio.
So glad to be here. Thanks.
Well, the book opens with the scene of you witnessing one of these roundups. And we'll get into some of the politics around why the horses are getting rounded up and what happens to them. But take us back to that. You were in a canyon, was it in Nevada? And you were there witnessing how these horses get rounded up by the BLM.
Yeah, if there is a middle of nowhere in the United States, I was right in the center of it. Just way past the signs that warn you that there's not gas for 100 miles. And I had gone out to see a government roundup of some of these horses. And these roundups happen all the time, year-round, all over the West. The idea being that there's only a certain amount of grass on the land. It can only support a certain number of horses. And when there's too many, the government will remove them. The way they do that is they use helicopters to just sweep over the desert and round up the horses. And they drive them towards a big circular corral that has two fences coming off of the entrance, almost like jaws that just reach out into the desert, or like a funnel. And the helicopters drive the horses oftentimes for miles, sometimes as much as 10 miles towards the funnel. Into the funnel, and someone closes the gate, and to see it, it is starkly efficient. The day that I described at the beginning of the book started at dawn, and I looked around, and I could see for dozens of miles in every direction and saw no horses. And by the end of the day, the helicopters had gathered up more than 100 and put them on trucks to go off into the government storage system.
We'll talk about that government storage system because that was mind-boggling, some of the statistics around that. But that image really just jumped out at me to witness that in, as you said, the middle of nowhere.
Well, it seems particularly brutal because as you read later in the book, you talk about how they were using airplanes. And at one point, the airplanes get outlawed, you know, in parts of Nevada or in the whole nation at some point. But now they've gone to helicopters, which seems worse. Did it strike you as being kind of brutal, or was it? I think the government wants you to think this is a humane treatment of horses, but how did it feel to you watching it?
You know, I think if you agree that horses should be removed, it is the most humane thing they have ever done. You know, if you rewind in history, the reason airplanes were so inhumane is they have to travel at a certain speed, and so you can literally run horses to death. A good helicopter pilot can be very humane in gathering horses. And look, ranchers use these for cows, too, and they don't want their cattle brutalized. They have to sell them in healthy conditions. So I think that should be a sign that this is relatively humane. What's more troubling is that what happens to the horses after. For decades, they were gathered, and the idea was that the horses that we will gather up and remove from the wild, we will let the American people adopt, and then they can use them as riding animals or as pets. And there were never enough adopters to handle the number of horses that were being removed. And so the government just quietly sold them to slaughter buyers, and they went to the meat factory.
Yeah, it was very surreptitious, though. They weren't supposed to be doing that, or right. People didn't think they were doing that, certainly.
Absolutely illegal. And yet, money finds a way.
Yeah, and you had broke a story as a reporter about a guy in 2012 or so, Tom Davis, I think, who was doing a lot of this. It was based in southern Colorado, who was buying hundreds of horses. I think you said 1,700 over maybe a four-year period, and they were mostly finding their way to slaughter, and yet the BLM was looking the other way.
Yeah, absolutely. The BLM was literally sending this guy truckload after truckload of horses, and he was paying $10 a piece for them, which I think it cost something like $700 a horse to gather them out of the desert. So not the best deal for the government. but he was willing to take these horses off their hands quietly that they didn't know what to do with. And as long as they didn't ask what was happening to them and he didn't tell them, they had, you know, at least plausible deniability. But yeah, he was within hours turning around and often with the same truck that they arrived in, shipping them down to Mexico where they went into slaughterhouses. When we called that out a couple of years ago, that arrangement stopped, but nothing ever happened to Davis or any of the people in the Bureau of Land Management that allowed that to happen for years.
Yeah, nobody faced any consequences.
No one even got fired. I mean, let alone like criminal consequences. They just said, oh, well, let's move on.
I remember reading that series when it came out, in that article, and just was horrified, really, by how this guy not just got away with it, but he was enabled, really, in many ways. And you talk about the Salazars now. Ken Salazar, former senator from Colorado, then former Secretary of the Interior, and you had an interaction with him over this issue. I mean, take our listeners back to that. Was it in Colorado Springs he was campaigning for
Obama? I want to be really careful with this. Ken Salazar at the time was the Department of Interior Secretary, which means that he was in charge of all wild horses and the BLM. Well, this guy that we talked about who was buying truckload after truckload of horses with nobody saying anything, he was literally lived down the road from Ken Salazar's ranch in the San Luis Valley and had done work for Salazar's family for decades. So as a reporter, I thought to myself, isn't it interesting that this arrangement happened with someone who has a relationship with the Secretary of Interior? Now, I was never able to show at all that there was any sort of arrangement. And when I spoke to Ken Salazar later, he said that he didn't even know this guy. But in the course of my reporting, Ken Salazar had been dodging my calls for a couple months. And he came to Colorado Springs to do some on-the-street campaigning for President Obama. This is right before his second term. And I thought, okay, he'll be on the street shaking hands. I'll be able to talk to him. And I talked to him, and he very quickly grew angry and came up to me and essentially said he felt set up by me. He didn't know I was going to be asking him about wild horses, and if I did that again, he was going to punch me in the face. He later apologized, perhaps under direction from the White House. I don't know. But I was quite surprised by his reaction.
I was quite surprised when I read it, when I read about that. But in terms of the Bureau of Land Management, I mean, they're the main federal agency in charge of the horses. Is that right?
Yeah. So they this is the land agency that took over all the land in the United States that no one else wanted after the whole homesteading thing was done. So if you can imagine, it's mostly dry land or steep land or rocky land, and oftentimes all of the above. And that is also where all of the wild horses, or almost all of the wild horses, still exist, because they were kind of driven into the areas of the West where we were not. And so it made sense when we passed a law to protect wild horses about 40 years ago that, hey, they're already on BLM land. We'll have the BLM take care of them. And they have, although they've really always done it from a point of view not of a wildlife biologist necessarily, but of an agency that was more or less created to be a referee for livestock producers. And they still kind of view and manage wild horses as livestock.
Yeah, they've set a kind of arbitrary number, it seems like, of 27,000 horses, which they've almost never been able to get down to, you say, you know, or maybe never have gotten down to 27,000 horses. But having that number drives all these roundups, is kind of driving the policy. And now there's more horses that they've rounded up and are holding than are actually wild anymore at this point.
That's pretty much true, although let me add a couple things. So the Bureau of Land Management says, hey, we think that sustainably we can have 27,000 horses on the land. And there are all sorts of wild horse advocates who will say, well, that's way low. It should be X or Y. The truth is that as imperfect as those numbers are, they are the most perfect numbers we have, because no one else has ever done any type of real scientific study of what the carrying capacity is. Okay, so let's stick with that number just for the sake of argument. The problem is that unless you come up with another plan of how you're going to sustainably manage horses on the land, you're going to have to remove them forever. You know, the herds will never stop increasing. You know, it's like you are just going to keep carrying water from a spigot without ever questioning how you might turn the spigot.
Yeah, it's really a conundrum. You know, I thought the 27,000 number, which, you know, if that seems to be what they can do, is interesting, because for a long time, and you go back to the history here, there is varying estimates, 1 million horses, several hundred thousand, maybe 2 million horses. You know, so in the history of the country, you know, maybe 100 years ago from now, the land held so many more horses.
Yeah, so the descriptions from some of the first people who crossed the plains in the 1830s and 40s, they describe herds that were really only comparable to the buffalo. You know, herds that would take an hour to ride past, herds that looked like waves of the sea. There are no good estimates, but the most agreed upon estimate was maybe about 2 million horses that covered the entire West. Of course, the West isn't what it was 100 years ago. You know, we now have 100 million people and a lot of barbed wire and asphalt. So the horses have really been driven to a few places where there is still open range and not too much competition from cities or mining or cattle, which is not very many places, usually very far from where people live.
You have a nice passage early in the book where you talk about how the horses have to try to survive on not ideal conditions. And I was wondering if you could just read this short passage, which comes pretty early in the introduction of the book, actually.
Yeah, so I wanted to give a taste of the patchwork of places where the wild horse herds still are. Each one of these patches is given a designation by the BLM, and some of them are really poetic. So this is just a description of wild horse country. The official government names of the designated wild horse ranges in wild horse country give some taste of the landscape. Granite, lava beds, slate range, high rock, sand canyon, sand basin, sand springs, black mountain, bald mountain, dead mountain. Just reading them makes you thirsty. They are the names that map the history of people who came looking for something and instead found only what a curator with dirty bifocals at a roadside Nevada History Museum described to me as nothing but miles and miles and miles and miles. They are names of want, failure, hideouts, last stands, and the wind. Names of places that even the hardy homesteaders we learn about in school sized up and then passed over. Stinking water, salt wells, rattlesnake, dog skin, devil garden, murderer's creek, dead man's valley, confusion, Harvey's fear. It's not the land the horses chose. It is just the land that was left to choose. Hardscrabble islands of desiccated emptiness that herds were pushed into. Put together the patchwork where the wild horses are still found in the West, and you have an area about the size of Alabama and a human population near zero.
That's author David Phillips reading from his new book, Wild Horse Country: The History, Myth, and Future of the Mustang. He's our guest today on the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU, Arsene Kashkashian, as always, my co-host. He's the head buyer at the Boulder Bookstore. In terms of where the horses came from, you write a lot about the tension between, you know, the concept that the horses are almost an invasive species, that they're left over from domestic horses that were just left run wild. But then you spend some time on an archaeological dig that uncovers, you know, teeth and jaws from horses going back hundreds and hundreds and, you know, millennia before that. So what is this idea of whether the horses are native or whether they're invasive that have been introduced?
This is a really important question. Does the horse belong in America, or is it a feral stray? Is it an invasive species? That matters in terms of how you manage it, right? Is it something that you have to, quote unquote, manage and remove, which is where we are now? Or is it something that, like deer, like red-tailed hawks, like bighorn sheep, should be there, and you should just leave to, as much as possible, find its own stasis? I thought that I knew the answer when I started. You know, horses were domestic. They were brought here by the Europeans as domestic animals. And the wild horses we see today are the horses that got away. Some of them got away centuries ago from the Spanish. Some of them got away from the native tribes. Some of them got away maybe in the 1950s or even the 1990s. So it's this real mismatch, and clearly from a domestic herd, right? So it makes sense that it is an invasive non-native species. But then I started finding out more about where horses came from way back. I mean, way before the conquistadors. And it turns out that 50 million years ago, at the dawn of the sort of the beginning of the mammal era, the wild horse came from basically right here, Boulder, the Rocky Mountain front. At the time, the area was a thick, deciduous jungle. And the wild horse, or at least its ancestor, was a small, maybe only a little bit bigger than a cat, forest dweller, something with tender teeth that nibbled on soft leaves. And gradually, the Earth changed. 50 million years ago, almost the entire globe was jungle. It was a greenhouse world where alligators lived at the poles. And over the millennia, it has cooled. It's become more dry, and something that was almost non-existent then became one of the dominant covers of the landscape, and that's grass. Grass spread everywhere, and with it, the horse had to change. It became more able to eat harsh foods. It became more able to travel long distances. It became more able to run fast and see far to avoid predators on the open plains. It grew in size. It became what it was really right here in North America over the span of 50 million years. And it only disappeared very recently, say about 10,000 years ago, when the first human hunter showed up. So the question is, if an animal lived here with all of the native species that now live here and all of the native plants that live here for 50 million years and then disappeared 10,000 years ago, is it still native? Is there still memory in the land? And there are definitely some biologists who argue, yeah, it is a native that essentially took a break and came back. But when it came back, one of the reasons it was so wildly successful, one of the reasons that there were soon 2 million free-roaming wild horses, is because it was made for this land.
Well, and also, wouldn't some of its natural predators have also been killed off during the same kill by the Clovis people that killed off the horses?
So that's right.
It was even more favorable to them in some ways.
Absolutely. So at the time that the first human hunter showed up, there was essentially a North American cheetah, a big cat that could hunt on the open plains, which we no longer have, and probably is the reason that the horse can run so fast. It's no longer here. And so it certainly had predators, but some of its predators were gone.
One of the most fascinating aspects of the history of the horse, you talk about how a lot of them escaped during the Pueblo Revolt of the 17th century. But when you bring it pretty close to our time now, they were being used for dog food. You know, they were being rounded up and they were being turned into dog food, really. And probably the 30s and the 40s, I think this was mostly, 20s, 30s, 40s. And I was wondering if you could talk some about that and how this was really, people could just gather up the horses for free during that time period.
Yeah. So how did we get from 2 million horses in about maybe 1850 down to 20,000 by 1950? And the reason is that horses in the West were treated like everything else in the West. It was a bounty there for the taking. If you could get it and you could get it to the market, pretty much it was yours. Horses were varmints, essentially, that could be rounded up by anyone as long as you could catch them. Now, for a long time, there wasn't enough of a market that you could do anything with 2 million horses. And so a number of states, including Colorado, in fact, Colorado was the first, just simply put bounties on horses. They were seen as a nuisance that ate grass that could be better put to use for cattle or sheep. And so if you shot one and brought in the ears, you could get $20. That started to change when the railroads reached into the West. And all of a sudden, you had a way to get vast numbers of horses to markets. Now, what were those markets? It was a surprising number of things. They were the main muscle for streetcars in Manhattan. They pulled all kinds of plows in the South. But they also went to factories where people realized that you could can them as meat and either ship them to Europe or sell them here as dog food. And that started about 1920, and millions of cans worth of horses were sold that way as kennel ration. And at the time, they made no secret that it was horse meat. That was seen as something wholesome for your dog. And by the 50s, the market had been so successful that there were hardly any left. It's sort of like the story of the Lorax, where they cut down all the truffula trees and they have to shut the factory down. That's what happened to the kennel ration factory. There were so few horses that they turned the lights off.
You have so many great characters in this book. And one of my favorite characters to read about was this guy, Frank Litz, I believe. And he objected to horses being made into dog food. He was an early kind of what we would see as an animal rights person almost. Can you tell briefly the story of Frank and what he did?
Yeah, he was an animal rights activist before that existed. So in the 1920s, when one of these first big factories started up in Illinois, he was a cowboy in Montana, had grown up around horses his whole life. And when he realized that other cowboys around Miles City, Montana, where he lived, were getting paid to round up wild horses, put them on trains to the meat factory, he was completely outraged. He saw the horse as a companion, as a friend to man, and certainly to the cowboy, and that anyone who would treat him that way was criminal. And so what he decided to do was go and blow up the factory. And he tried several times to burn it down, and one time he was pretty successful and burned down about half of the factory. But they rebuilt and kept going. And so he was finally caught one night when he brought a huge suitcase full of dynamite to the plant and had lit the fuse and taken off, but was caught while he was trying to escape and did not successfully blow up the plant. He was jailed. He was actually found criminally insane rather than found guilty of a crime and put in an asylum for the rest of his life. He tried to escape. He actually did escape and try and blow up the factory again, and they put him back in the asylum. And it's an amazing story. It's amazing how dedicated he was, and in ways he really was eccentric. But it touches on a larger theme that has come up again and again since. A number of times when the Bureau of Land Management has talked about taking excess wild horses and killing them, or been caught secretly allowing wild horses to get killed, similar things have happened. Their corrals have been firebombed. Their facilities have been firebombed. And I think that there is a element in the United States that is so enamored by the wild horse and by the myth of the horse, who it is to us as a people, that they just can't stand for it to be destroyed.
There's another great character, another horse advocate, Wild Horse Annie, who I think followed a truck one day. She was in Nevada and she saw blood dripping from it, and she thought, oh, maybe it's a cattle carcass, and then followed it to its end and then saw that it was actually a wild horse, and that really changed her life. Talk a little bit about her.
Wild Horse Annie is the reason that we have a federal law protecting horses in the first place. She was a secretary in Reno, not really anyone who particularly would have been this person, but she saw that wild horses were being rounded up by airplanes and really mistreated and hauled to hauled to the meat plants. At that point, I think they were just grinding them up for fertilizer. And she just thought it was wrong. This was 1950 when the wild horse myth was perhaps at its strongest. You know, you think of all the 50s cowboy shows and movies. And she decided she was going to do something about it. And as a secretary, what she could do most, this sounds sort of outrageous, but it was really effective, is she could organize. And she could type. And she just sent letters to everyone she could think of. And she organized small groups of people all over the West that would urge lawmakers to pass a law. And eventually in 1971, Congress, which was deluged from letters from children from all over the country saying you have to save these animals, acted. And they acted in a way they would never act today. It was the era of sweeping federal environmental laws. That's when we had the Endangered Species Act, clean water, clean air, all these things that now I think people would be hesitant to put through Congress because they're so broad and sweeping. And this was the same. They protected all horses where they were with just this one act and put them under a federal agency. And ever since, that has been the moment that has been dictating the lives of these horses.
Well, in terms of the federal management of it now, we started talking about the BLM roundup and their holding areas for these horses. And Arson, you mentioned that there are now more wild horses in captivity than there are actually wild, at a tremendous cost. Did you say something like $1 billion is what this will be costing in a few years? More expensive to hold the horses than it is to actually manage the population out on the,
right,
the wild.
So we have spent so far in the history of the program $1 billion to round up and store horses. And with the horses that are already in storage, the liability is another $1 billion. So it has gotten very expensive. And when I say storage, here's what I mean. When horses are rounded up by helicopter and put into a truck, they are put up for adoption, and very few of them are adopted. And so the government pays ranchers in the Midwest, largely in the Flint Hills of Oklahoma and Kansas, to store these horses at a per diem. And they're spending something like $50 million a year to do this. And they have not figured out any way out of it. They're still storing more and more horses every year. Now, it is not quite true that there are more horses in storage than in the wild. It was a few years ago, but now the storage is so full that they're leaving more and more horses on the range, and that population is growing. So right now we have about 75,000 horses in the wild and maybe about 50 in storage.
Well, David Phillips is the author of Wild Horse Country, The History, Myth and Future of the Mustang, and he has been our guest on this Thursday morning here at the Radio Book Club. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As we always do at the end of the Radio Book Club, we like to announce the next selection and invite people to read along. But there's lots to talk about right now because there's a live taping opportunity coming up in April. And also we have an extra book club edition coming up because there are so many books coming out right now.
Yeah, we're actually telling you about three books rather than one this time around. But the next book on the book club will be Don't Skip Out on Me, by Willie Vallotton. This is just a wonderful Western book set in a Nevada ranch. Some of the same territory we've just been talking about with David Phillips.
And he has a new film coming out. There is a film coming out of one of his previous books, so people might be aware of him. Lean on Pete is just out in the movie theaters. That's based on a previous book. But Don't Skip Out on Me, it's a gorgeous read. It really is full of characters that you'll fall in love with. And Willie Vallotton will... The interview with Willie Vallotton will air on Thursday, April 26th. That's at 9 a.m. But right after that, we're inviting people to come along to see a live taping of the Radio Book Club. That's with Elizabeth Hyde, and that's happening at the Boulder Bookstore on Saturday, April 28th. And her new book is Go Ask Fanny.
Yeah, Elizabeth is a local Boulder author. She's had a number of good novels, and this is her newest one. I'm looking forward to talking to her about it.
So come by the Boulder Bookstore in person Saturday, April 28th. It's Independent Booksellers Day. We'll be there at 3 p.m. That interview will air May 24th, but just to add an extra book in the mix, on May 10th, we've got a special extra edition of the Radio Book Club, just because this is an author we could not let come through town and not have come to the book club. Tiare Jones has a new novel out. It's An American Marriage.
Yeah, this is a really heartfelt novel about a young African-American couple where the man is wrongfully incarcerated and kind of the havoc that it does to their relationship. It's really beautifully written.
You can hear Tiare Jones on air at 9 a.m. on May 10th. Her book is An American Marriage. All of the details of all of these books and the upcoming events are online at kgnu.org. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU, along with my co-host Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. Thanks for listening.